ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Speaking Out.
We're mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration,
and energy. I just want to talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition.
With Larissa Berendt.
It's a fresh view coming
on ABC Radio.
This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Berendt. Among the many problems we've been facing at the moment, one of the biggest issues is how we can better protect our children, from juvenile justice to mental health, and looking at the reforms needed in both the childcare and out-of-home care sectors. On this episode, I'll be joined by two of their biggest advocates, the National Commissioner for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Children and Young People, Sue-Ann Hunter. Then later, Snake CEO Catherine Little joins me to talk about a program that is making a difference in early childhood learning for our kids. Last year, the position of National Commissioner for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Children and Young People was introduced by the federal government. The position was filled by Wurundjeri and Ngai Ilim Wurrung woman, Sue-Ann Hunter. Prior to taking on the role, she spent many, many years working across the Aboriginal community-controlled sector in Victoria as a social worker. During this time, she learnt how important it is to hold space for people to share their experiences in order to help change from within.
I was a bit later in life, I think, in coming into really sort of, I hate the word activism because anyway, I was, you know, sort of where I want to be with my people. And I was just working corporate Australia for a while. I was in my early 20s. Actually, I don't even think I was in my 20s. I think I was a bit younger. And I just was really listening to Nan's stories about her being on Corran Dirk, being born on Corran Dirk on a mission. And then, you know, stories about her life and also my dad's life and just really understanding the marginalisation and of our people. And I thought, what is it that I can do to help? And that's when I first started working at VACCA and I became a caseworker. And I wasn't even a social worker then. And just really, really wanting to help the next generation. I don't know. I think it's innate in us when we're born as First Peoples. We just want to help. And I was sick of working for corporate Australia and just making other people money. I thought, what is the difference I can make? And that was working with our kids in out-of-home care. And I just loved it. I just loved making a difference or seeing our kids smile. But the heartache that comes with it is a lot. And I think from that moment I was like, how can I make a difference? This isn't okay, our kids should be able to see their parents, our kids shouldn't be removed. How do we help our families? You know, how do we stop the overrepresentation of prison population? And how do we deal with trauma? Because we can relate it all back to that. So they're my early years and, just lots of journey along the way to get to where I am today. I was actually reflecting on this the other day and I was sitting in a room going, how did I get here? Talking about legislation, how did I get here in this room? And I really had to pinch myself, but at the same time, it's like 30 years later and I'm still fighting for the same and saying the same thing.
Well, you are, but in another way, you know, I think I can see such an evolution and you might call it activism, but I always think of you as an advocate. And there must have been a moment when you were doing that on the ground, face-to-face, coalface work. And what I've admired about you is you've moved from that into real systems change to change the bigger picture. And I wondered if there was a moment that triggered that for you where you actually thought, not going to be a cog in the wheel, I need to do something bigger.
I never thought it'd be a commissioner, let alone a commissioner twice. So I just remember working on the ground in these systems going, these systems aren't working on the ground. Yet there's people that make these decisions and write these policies and write how we work, but they don't even understand it. So when the opportunity come to step up into something bigger, I was like, well, there's not many people in these positions that have done the groundwork. And I thought that has to be, which I think is quite unique. So how do I guess what I've done with that is when in these roles that I've been able to say, hey, that doesn't work on the ground. Like, let's think logically. Because what I've realised as you sort of move around in these spaces is that there's not a I shouldn't say it like, hang on, I was going to say there's not a lot of doers, but I think there's a lot of people that know how to, what's written on paper, how you do that in practice. And I think there's a real big disconnect, and I love to connect those two pieces together. So is it what's written on the paper good enough to be implemented on the ground, or what's on the ground, should that then be implemented in paper? So it's tricky space, but I don't think we think enough about what our policies look like to how they're implemented on the ground. And I love to be that middle person who really brings that conversation into the system change spaces.
You're so right that a lot of policymakers have not had that experience on the ground, so don't have that kind of practical approach to how something's going to work. When you came in from working on the ground and had that practical approach, what surprised you most when you got into the space of actually working more broadly in policy?
Oh, it was that thing that no one had really had that practical experience on the ground or understood the people we were serving, because that's what we do. We serve those people that need this system. And how hard it is to change it and how entrenched it is in this way of working. And I don't think that will ever change. But there's this way of working that's not working but is working for the people in there. Does that make sense? So how do we change it to work for people on the ground? And sometimes people see it as extra added work on them, workload. And sometimes it is, but I think there's better ways of working than what we're doing now, and that is right across Australia in every forum. It's not working for people that need these services.
You're also someone I've observed over the year to whom place, culture and identity really matter. How do you embed that connection to land, water, culture and community into systemic reform for children and young people? And I guess I've asked you how you've brought your practical experience. How do you bring that cultural grounding into it as well?
Oh, look, it's meeting, because in this new role, and I know we haven't gone there yet, it's really about highlighting the voices of our children and youth and bringing them into policy. How do we do that? We meet them where they are and we break down the system in a way that they understand. And then we maintain their voices about how this needs to be changed. But we meet them where they're at, and we do it on their country, in their terms, and what where they're safe, because that's what keeps them safe, right, and resilient. And so for me, everything we do with MOB, and particularly our children and young people, needs to be done with grounded in culture, grounded in their country, grounded in their identity, grounded in who they are. And we can only do that if we meet them where they are.
It'll be clear to anyone who's listening why you were an ideal choice for the National Commissioner of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Children. But what made you think this was a step that you wanted to take? What made you put your hand up for the role?
Well, I know that's a big question. So one of the things I did do was talk to my daughter about, it's a big role and there'll be a lot of time away from her. And she said, it was so beautiful. She said, Mum, you need to help other kids too, which but I needed to ask her because it's a big job and it's national. You know, we connect our own way. I was part of the avocation for this role early on when I was in Family Matters. And I think for me, it was a next step in my career. It's a next step in nurturing our next generation and getting their rights embedded in everything that happens in this country and elevating their voices. And I guess being a national, nationally, how do we also bring that together with a coordinated approach from all the other children's commissioners, advocates and guardians? Because you can't do this role alone. And so one of the things is, how do we bring everybody together to make sure our children are safe? And it's, for me, part of the role is the coordination of bringing And I think everybody wants the same thing. We just all do it differently. So how do we get one voice and start on track of doing it together?
Now that you've started the role, do you have a set of key priorities? What are the things that were sort of high on your list of things that you felt you wanted to tackle now that you're there in the role?
So two of the main issues, and, you know, we could not even shy away from them, is out-of-home care for our kids and the justice system. And, of course, they reached two of the closing the gap targets, 11 and 12. So they're high on the priority, and that also is going to take a national effort of how we turn the tide on those two issues. At the moment, we don't have legislation, but we're working on it with government. And so once that's in and we'll have our whole, all of our functions, we'll be, I'll be able to give a better, I guess, a better mandate. But at the moment, we're putting together a framework of how we're going to work with kids, young people and children, and get their voices amplified. So a framework, a child safe sort of framework of engagement. Because part of our role is to amplify their voices. We can still provide advice to government because that's sort of part of our role, and collaborating with the key stakeholders, as I said before, like that collective impact can drive systemic reform. It doesn't sound like a lot, but we don't have a legislation at the moment. So as soon as we get that through, and it's we are working on it, so it is going to go through. Things might change or amplify a bit. And so we should be able to do inquiries when we see things, the system that are just not okay. And how do we do an inquiry and make recommendations to government?
Not surprisingly, you've picked the two big issues, out-of-home care and the justice system for young people. Just from your perspective, these two things don't sit on their own either. They're quite interconnected. And I wondered if you had any reflections on how they intersect just from your own experience and your knowledge of the areas.
Yeah, I guess, look, our children aren't in silo. What you'll find is most of our children that have been removed aren't connected to culture, country, or even sometimes their people. And so that is a trauma in itself, because that forms your identity, right? And he put into a foreign place with foreign people, not understanding who you are and having trauma that's not being healed, is a pipeline to juvenile justice. And so we see that regularly, and we've seen that for a long time. I think the answer lies in the collective of how we deal with that. Something needs to change. We can't continue. The rates are going up in both systems. But I think one of the things that I really want to do is really sit down and talk with these young people and children and really get their voices about what didn't work for them and what did work for them and what would be their ideal system. And then how do we get that through to policy, I guess, and the government to understand what's going on.
In your work, clinical practice, policy, governance, and of course the work you've done around the truth-telling process in Victoria, you've had an opportunity to go out and listen to people already. And I just wonder if you've got any reflections from the testimonies you've already listened to. And no doubt, knowing you, you've hit the ground running and you're already talking to people now as well. But what sorts of things are you hearing? What sorts of stories are having a real impact on your thinking around the role?
Oh, I think the one thing is Aboriginal kids and Aboriginal care. If you look in, because everything's, I think the thing with this role is all the states and territories have different legislation, and then we've got the Commonwealth. And so it's really hard of where we look at and what are the levers I could use, particularly once we get legislation, of how we can make a difference. And that's also in conjunction with the commissioners, guardians and advocates in each state and territory. But there's already good things happening, and I think we need to highlight the good stuff more and be able to fund it more. And that's where we get better outcomes. I guess where, and look, I learned this at York, and I think we all know this, the further you get away from the cities and more into remote, the less services you get, or the less frequency of services you get. So how do we work with that, and what does that look like? That everybody gets the service they deserve. And I think it's tricky as to who's funding who and where the legislation sits in that state or territory or, you know, jurisdiction. And there's stuff we've got to nut out along the way. But I just want to highlight there's good stuff happening. I think one of the things I want, really want, is people underestimate our children and young people. And how do we amplify the good stuff, not just these systems that aren't working? We need to work on these systems. But there's kids out there doing really good things. And so I think we need to highlight some of that as well.
Yeah, I think that's so true. We often hear the stories of the negative impacts. And as you say, there's a lot of power in being able to identify what's worked. And as you highlight, one of the threads that seems to come through are the idea of self-determination, that actually young people have deep, careful thoughts around what works and what doesn't. Community-controlled organisations have that too. So I wonder if you could share with us, as you've gone around, what are some of those places where you have seen transformation that's been driven by the community or by young people, examples that really reinforce that view that self-determination does work and that there are answers sitting there for complex questions?
I guess, you know, it's really tricky because I've only been in this role 6 weeks, but I can talk about Victoria. They also have the Noogle program. So that program that sits in VACA is self-determination. So they will do the investigations for the children. They have the management of these children. And I don't have the stats on me, but they get a lot of kids home and the parents are more than happy to work with Noogle program because it's sort of self-determination. And we've had more kids go home in that program. And I haven't been there, but I have heard a lot of good things. There's Abcare in Moree who are doing some really good things, keeping kids safe and off the streets and out of juvenile justice. It depends where you're going. So I haven't heard a lot yet, but, you know, we're getting our socials up and running soon. And when we get out and about, we'll definitely be really getting out those good things that our kids are doing.
And I note that obviously, as you said, you've already been on the process of the truth-telling commissioner with your rook and your extensive work in the area. So it's not like you're coming not knowing what kind of work is there that can be built on. So it's quite exciting to see what will happen when you're able to have a more national view of what's going on and bring that all together. I'm sure that'll be a really powerful thing. I did want to ask you a few things about your time with your rook and as a truth-telling commissioner, because the last time we spoke, you were in the middle of that. And I wonder, when you reflect on it, what were some of the key things that you learnt in doing that role?
Oh, there's lots. And the longer I'm sort of away from it, the more I've realised how much I've learnt. I've learnt a lot going into this role of setting up a commission. And you don't think about those things. You think you can just go in and do it. So I understand legislation a lot more now. I think we did really well on keeping our people safe. I wish we had had more time to get the trust of a lot more people and that you can't rush these things. Even though we have these timeframes, you can't rush them. People have their own timeframes, particularly coming and telling their truth around trauma, and that our community is so generous. They come time and time again with full faith in us as Aboriginal people to be able to tell their story to get change. So I guess just seeing myself as a facilitator of voice more than a commissioner and being able to see the transformation or the healing power in being able to tell your story, I think it was such an honour. Like, there's no one else that gets to do what we did at this point or gets to sit in the places that we sat. And I think there's some things that are quite personal which change you as a person. And then there's other things where you go, maybe I'll do this a lot better to honour these people. But I think our people are, and I hate the word because I say this all the time, I've got to find a new one, but our people are so resilient. They have strength and they keep advocating even though things take such a long time to change. And it's just made me love my people more.
I was going to ask you, you sort of touched on it, but I'd love to know more about how going through this process changed you.
Oh, I guess understanding my privilege that I've had from those that come before me, that fought for us to do things like the commission, to fought for us to actually even, you know, have a rally for our people. Hearing the stories that our people have gone through have changed things, not just the big voices that you know of their stories, but the little quiet voices in the background that are working behind the scenes to make change. I guess, you know, hearing stories of police brutality, hearing stories of deaths in custody, hearing stories to tell you around why, you know, there's no reasoning, but people were taken and, you know, never got to see their family till 40, 50 years later, and some didn't even, still don't know who they are. They make me fight harder, and I think I carry them with me. And it just makes me hug my baby tighter at night too, you know, and appreciate everything we've got. And, you know, if I've got this privilege now, then I need to use it in the best way possible to create change for our people. You know, there's lots of tears, and sometimes things hit you when they probably shouldn't, they're probably the wrong time. I think I was called at one point too emotional, but, you know, these are heart stories, and if you can't meet people where they're at, I just don't know what you're doing in these roles.
I'm not sure that too emotional is a bad thing when you're listening to those stories of people, and you wouldn't want to be somebody that's not able to empathise and sympathise with what you're hearing. So, but I wonder too, having gone through the process, and you talked about how transformative it was for people who could give evidence, who I guess you listened to when their stories hadn't been heard before. Mm. But on reflection now, I mean, you were part of the first truth-telling process in the country. And on reflection, what do you think the real benefits have been more broadly for such a process? What are your thoughts on how it might continue to play a role in terms of the relationship between First Nations people and the rest of the country?
I think the problem is once you know, you can't go back. And so some people just don't want to know. But there's a lot of people that were, oh, my God, I didn't know this. And I still can't believe that. I'm still in shock that people say that in, you know, 2025. But people don't know. So opening people's eyes to the history of this, of that state of Victoria, I think it had a profound effect for people. There's a saying we have in social work, lean into the discomfort, and I really encourage people to do that. So when we were taking truths, we weren't just taking truths from First Peoples. We actually took truths from some of the descendants of some of the people that did the colonising. By the way, they were our most watched and seen footage that we had online. And I think that really hit home from people, white people saying, and I mean derogatory when I say the white, but white people telling of their descendants of what they did to Aboriginal people and owning it really changed a lot of people, that they've gone and looked at their history and into their history about what their ancestors did. And the good thing about that is we weren't blaming them. We're like, we need to understand this. We need to know this so we don't do it again. It's tricky, right? Because people need to know it, but they don't want to know it.
That feels quite profound, because there's this sort of myth that's been perpetuated around the telling of truth around the experiences of Aboriginal people historically through colonisation, that it is inevitably about shaming. But listening to you speak as somebody who has gone through this quite profound process of truth-telling, overseeing it, it sounds like it's much more complex than that. And actually to say it's about shame about the past really oversimplifies it and oversimplifies the genuineness that non-Aboriginal people come to the conversation with.
Yeah. I was having a conversation before this with somebody, and we were talking about truth-telling in the education setting. And I said, well, you're going to need to ask people what's their version of truth-telling or what does it mean to them, because everybody has a different version. And I think if we understand why we do it and there's a purpose to doing it. And the purpose is that it doesn't happen again and that we get justice for what did happen. And we can see that happening in the state of Victoria at the moment with the treaty. And so there's a purpose for people to come and tell their stories, and they feel like there's something bigger than. And I tell you, when people, particularly non-Indigenous people, come with us on that journey and you see the change, it's amazing. But I mean, it's happened. We can't change what's happened, but how can we change as we go forward? And it's not even that simple, right? It's quite complex when you get down and you're in it, like we were in it for 4 years, that you start thinking, well, it's not just this, it's this, and it's also not that, it's this. It's quite big, and there's so much work to still be done. And even though we've done a Royal Commission and we lasted 4 years, there's a whole plethora of truth-telling still to be done.
One of the things that your work with the Commission brought out was the revelation of the really deep systemic failures that were a part of that historical process. You also, of course, captured incredible resilience as well. And they seem to be two threads that you're going to find in your new role. And I just wondered, it seems like there would have been great learnings from that process that you'll bring to the new role. And I wondered if you had any reflections on that.
One of the things I like about this role is that is the National Commissioner is an accountability mechanism to hold government to account. And so I've learnt a lot about that in Yuruk. And I think I want to bring that, well, I do, I want to bring those learnings into this commission, because we're all accountable, right? And you can't change a system until you hold someone to account to actually change that system. And that's part of the role as the National Commissioner. My favourite thing in Yuruk was holding space for people. And what's even more I'm going to love is holding space for children and young people, my favourite people in the world, being able to sit with them but really deeply listen, meet them where they're at in a really safe space for them that they're actually going to be heard. And being able to reflect that back to them, is this what I heard, and is this what you're saying? Because I think as a young person, you don't feel heard, particularly if you're in those systems.
If you look forward 5 years, 10 years, what changes would you hope to see in this space as a result of your work as the National Commissioner?
Oh, I guess that the rights of the children are being upheld. I don't know if we're ever going to completely stop out-of-home care or juvenile justice. I don't think we will, but that kids aren't getting locked up. There's a different response. I just think sometimes our responses need to be medical rather than punitive lockups or removal. I think there's things like mental health. There's things like, for parents, drug and alcohol. How do we treat the symptoms of the outcome of children being removed or locked up? And I think until we get to the symptoms, we're not going to get the reduction. I also think that early intervention, like helping families, rather than sitting at the bottom of the cliff waiting for them to fall, why aren't we getting in there earlier? And I know SNCC's doing a lot of work around that, but I think there's a lot more work that needs to be done about getting in a whole lot earlier. But I think system change can only happen if we're looking at the system from the symptoms rather than the punitive end of what the outcome is of those symptoms.
We've talked about the importance of listening, of giving space for people to tell their stories, which has been an integral part of work that you've done and that you're continuing to do in the new role. We've spoken about, I guess, the responsibilities of governments to listen, of the challenges around bureaucracy, and we've spoken about what the importance is of the role of community-controlled organisations and the agency of First Nations people. There's another element in that, which is, I guess my question to you would be, for people who are listening, who are not First Nations, but want to be good allies in the space of protecting the rights of children, in supporting the kind of issues that you're working on, what does it take, or what does good allyship look like in this space?
Oh, there's a few things. I always say to people, how do you make a difference in what you can control? So what's in your little space of the world that you are living in that you can change to make life better? Do you even understand the rights of the child? Do you understand UNDRIP? Do you understand where I guess it starts with, do you understand the ground you're walking on and where you live? What is it that you have control of that you can change in your little part of the world? And whether that's just checking in on a child, whether that's just, you know, making sure they're okay, or even speaking up when our mob kids aren't in the room. Like, I think that's the biggest thing. And when you see an injustice, are you going to speak up, or are you going to just let it go? I think being a good ally is understanding the landscape of the world, the small bit of the world that you can control. I could give you a list of things about being a good ally, but I guess the thing I always say to people is, I can give you that list, but what are you prepared to do? Or what are you prepared to give up to do? And sometimes it might be that you need to give up. By speaking up, you might actually have to give up a friendship, or you might have to give up going into that space again. Or are you prepared to do that? Like, what are you prepared to do to be a really good ally for the First Nations people in your circle?
That was the recently appointed National Commissioner for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Children and Young People, Sue Ann Hunter. Although she's new to the role, we're looking forward to what she does to support our community. With Sue Ann's love for black music, we thought it was only right to bring back this iconic performance from the First and Forever concert in 2022. This song, The Children Came Back, features powerhouses Briggs, Emma Donovan and Paul Kelly.
Let me see your hands. Front to back, side to side, up to back. I'm Fitzroy with Jack Charlesby. I'm Wanganine in 93 on Monday. I'm Cassidy. Flow inside of me. I'm Adam Goods, and Adam should be applauded when he stands up. You can look to us when our time stops. I'm Patty Mills, but the last shot I'm gone. I'm marching. I'm everything that you ask me. I'm everything that you can't be. I'm the dead heart, heartbeat. Now let's go.
The children came back. The children came back.
I'm going and I'm marching.
Back where the hearts go strong.
I'm Doug Nichols, I'm Jimmy Little, with a royal telephone. On the world champion 68, boy I'm Lionel Rose. I'm William Cooper, I take a stand when no one even knows. I'm the walker, I'm the sounder, those children coming home. Boy I'm cool, and I'm marching, and I'm everything that you ask me. And I'm everything that you can't be, I'm a dead heart. Heartbeat, now
the
clap!
Children came back.
Now clap!
The children came back. Back where their hearts go strong. Back where they all
belong. Yoda's in the building, shepherd's in the house. So let me take it home, I'm from. On the sand hills, I'm coming. I'm Lesbridge, I'm Paul Bridge. I'm Uncle Ringo with all their kids, I'm Mother One. Everybody loves me, ain't number love. Ain't none of what me, I'm the carving of the Irish guard tree. Oh, slash, fat, but fat, you now, Mr. Abbott. You think about it, me and you, we feel the same. That might sound strange, but I'm just saying we both unsettled when the boats came. Now I'm boom, and I'm marching, and I'm everything that you ask me. And I'm everything that you can't be. I'm the dead heart, heartbeat, let's go.
Back where their hearts were strong, back where they all belong, the children came back.
You're Boomer and you're Archie.
The children came back.
Let me see those hands rock watch.
The children came back.
I need Ruby and Uncle Jack.
Back where they understand.
And my man Dr. G.
The children came back.
I'm Boomer and I'm Archie.
To their people, back to their land.
That was a wonderful performance of The Children Came Back featuring Briggs, Emma Donovan and Paul Kelly.
On ABC Radio National,
we examine the forces that shape how we live.
And who we have become.
Health services fail Australians.
Governor of the Reserve Bank, Michelle Bullock.
From the economy.
To the big ideas.
From fearless debates.
To the events that timestamp our lives.
A political eruption across the United States.
Russia.
China. And they have veto.
Go deep.
To challenge.
To question.
And explore our complex world.
ABC Radio National.
This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Berendt. Earlier on the show, we heard from the National Commissioner of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Children and Young People, Sue Ann Hunter. She discussed the importance of community-based solutions to issues with the childcare and protection sectors. Recently, a review into the SNAKE Early Years Support Program found that services supported by the program were highly effective in providing culturally safe care for First Nations children. This demonstrates that there can be a solution that is led by self-determination that allows our kids to thrive early on in their childhood education journey. Catherine Little is the CEO of SNAKE, the Secretariat of National Aboriginal and Islander Childcare. She spoke to me about the review and what it means for early childhood learning moving forward.
The Aboriginal community-controlled early years services are quite remarkable, and all of them were stood up by, you know, grandparents and families that recognised there was no place. There was no place for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children to access the incredible benefit and network and community that Aboriginal services are able to give children in their early years. And, you know, this stuff's a no-brainer. We all know grandmother's law. We all know how important it is for our communities to wrap around children in the early years. So these little services are all over the country, and for a very long time they have been alone. And when I say alone, you know, that means there's no body that wraps around them to ensure that if they're having a hard day, they can reach out for support themselves. And this is really critically important, because while we always say that governments need to focus on the child and child-centred responses, if we're ever going to get close to closing the gap, because if everything a child has is available, then we know that our communities are strong. But when you listen to how the services themselves describe themselves, they'll often say that their job is on the floor to cradle children and make sure they're safe. They'll tell you that their services job is to cradle the family, to make sure that the families have what they need and that they're safe. And the early year support service that we offer was basically a call from our community controlled service to say, we need something that cradles us. We need something that gets us through the tough times. And that's effectively what the early years service does. It, much like the services themselves, it's bespoke, it's individualised. How it operates in any centre will be different to the next centre, from the next state. And it's been in pilot for 4 years now. It was one of the first projects rolled on a national reform agenda under the agreement on closing the gap. And it basically said we need a better way of giving those services the network support and strength and community that we give our children and we give our families. So the evaluations are through, and it's basically said it is true that Aboriginal community-controlled early years services are the gold standard in care delivery models in Australia. And it is true that the support network has reinforced that, strengthened that, and has brought them together as a community for the very first time. So right now we're looking at that, and we're looking at what all of our services experience, and that is a funding cliff. You know, there's never any sustainability to these incredible pilots that you're told to go off and develop. And we know that our early year services on the forefront of closing the gap. We know our services are on the forefront of ensuring that our children are ready and able to enter schooling systems to start their life journeys. And we know that our early year systems are critical to the economy and broader community supports in any environment that they might sit in. So really, it's time to pay more attention to what is needed, and it's time to be looking at what sustainability for these incredible services truly is.
There's a couple of things about that I want to pull out. The first is, of course, how important it is to have this kind of evidence base that supports what we see and know on the ground and what we hear anecdotally about the importance of community controlled and the way that self-determining approaches can give better outcomes. And the second thing that really strikes me hearing you speak is, of course, even the language you use around what is usually referred to as the child protection system, these ideas of cradling and the metaphors show a completely different mindset in the approach to these issues. And I wonder if we could draw that out a little bit more in terms of your thoughts and reflections on how it is that when things are designed by our community-controlled organisations, by our communities and our grandmothers, mothers and families on the ground, that that support differs from traditional childcare support systems.
Look, I think it goes to the heart of what Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people know. Intrinsically, we're born to it. And we hear it framed from a more academic concept as centering a child. And we've always known that if you start with children, what you have is a really strong society. And, you know, like most Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have had that great privilege of growing up under that law system that says that if every child is loved as though they are your own, that if every child is fed and if every child knows who to go to when they need help, then your communities will be strong. Now, that's a really simple way of describing a very complex but very supportive environment that understands that if you're starting with the children and they have everything that they need, then you are genuinely working with parents. And again, as our First Nations people have always understood, you know, we see our children as not belonging necessarily to a parent, but to a family, to a community, and everybody is responsible for helping to raise our children and creating that really safe environment. You know, we know that we have many mothers and many grandmothers and, you know, lots of sisters and brothers. So we understand a different way of caring and nurturing that says, when you walk into a service that's Aboriginal community controlled, the first thing you are going to feel is welcome and loved. And that's not throwing shade at the non-Indigenous services. You know, we know that they are valued and loved by the families that use them. And I could give you an example. I was visiting one of the services up in Broome. And again, you walk in and the first thing those children do is run up to you and climb up for a cuddle. Because as far as they're concerned, because you're in that centre which is safe and trusted, you are one of the people that are there to care and love them. And you find that in any of the Aboriginal services that you might visit, that is the first thing children do is run up and want to cuddle. Because that is what you're, as far as they're concerned, that is that your only purpose in the world is to keep them safe. So when that is fundamentally embedded into the way you operate, you do get a different nuance. And picking up on what you were, for lack of better terminology, putting down around child protection in and of itself, you know, Aboriginal service, child and family services, a very long time ago, moved away from the concept of child protection as it's understood in Australia and called themselves child care agencies. Now, that's not child care agencies as non-Indigenous people understood them. It was child care, and that is these services are the ones that care for the entirety of a child. And again, that's the basic premise that a peak body like SNAKE is formed around, and that is that we care for the whole of child and we care for the whole of family. So in and of itself, it's an entirely different way of approaching how we understand what you need to do to ensure children thrive.
The results of the evaluation that have so strongly indicated that this is the right approach, these are the right frameworks, the right positioning in terms of how to address some of the ongoing issues in the sector, obviously should be a platform for, as you indicated the expansion of this approach into other areas. Are there other programs or places where you would like to see an investment of the same kind?
Yeah, look, obviously SNAIC as a national provider always looks at those things that need whole of system reform, which means national reform. And what we know is that while every area is nuanced and beautiful for that nuance, you know, every area has its own responses and its own ambitions, and that's the way it should be. We know that there are always some common characteristics, and those common characteristics are that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, when they have access to services like this, want to use them and they want to see them expand. And some of our services have wait lists of up to 300 people and up to 3 years. That is how in demand they are. But in order to grow them, then we need to obviously be able to give them the support that they need. So we know that at this point in time, there is considerable effort on the ground in Queensland to look at this particular model, and South Australia as well to look at this particular model, and how it would roll out in any of those regions, again, is determined by those communities themselves and who's available to work in collaboration with on the ground. But we know that whenever we talk to people and whenever we talk to those services, they say, well, when can we link into this particular program? And again, Larissa, you'd be across the statistics, the latest AEC data that showed this massive backward slide in developmental outcomes for children across Australia. What it also showed for the very first time since the national agreement was brought in, but for the very first time ever, was while there was a slight backward trend in the developmental gains for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children, for the very first time it was effectively a stall in the statistics. And as you know, and most people online would know, when you see a massive national backward trend, you'd normally expect families with the highest levels of marginalisation or experiencing vulnerability to be the worst represented in those statistics. In Australia, that's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. In those statistics, for the very first time, they were the ones that performed the best, which is an incredible testament to the reform agenda that our early years services have been driving and the reforms that they've been able to bring in using those incredible voices of our children and families to change what early child care and education services look like for children and families across the country.
Given those outstanding results, you mentioned earlier that there were some challenges around sustainability in relation to some of the work you're doing. Can we just draw that out a little bit so that we really understand what the risks are here in terms of stopping programs or preventing programs from continuing that are showing really great results and seem to be having an impact finally on closing some of that gap?
Oh, look, you know, I was listening to one of the services yesterday, and she described it as, I'm sick of getting remarried. She put it as simply as that. I'm sick of getting remarried. And the reason she described it like that was across many, many years, we have seen programs come and go, and it is the nature and characteristic of how Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander services and programs have been funded across Australia. They're often couched as pilots. They're often short-term funding models. They're often things that come and go at the whim of whatever government's in play. And sometimes it's not even what government's in play. Sometimes it's as simple as a shift in minister, and they go in different directions. So one of the big pieces of work that is being driven under the priority reforms and the national agreement on closing the gap is the ability to start moving to, more relational funding. And again, that's a funny word, relational. It basically means move away from a transaction funding, which basically says, here we go, here's a level of dollars. And for those dollars, you are going to have access to this, this, and this, and for a period of 12 months. And over that period of 12 months, in exchange for that, we expect you to do this, 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 and this, right? They're very rarely what Aboriginal people want or need or are relevant to the communities that they're working in. And the new changes are looking at how we get embedded into funding agreements and relationships with the governments a new way of working that says, well, what is it that your community needs? And how do we ensure that the ability to respond to that need is there, that there are absolutely have to be checks and balances in, but you as a community are able to self-determine what success looks like. And again, when we talk about the early years review and the evaluation that you were speaking to, it is one of the first evaluation frameworks where communities themselves were able to feed into what they believed success would look like if the support was giving them the genuine foundational backing that it needed and the cradling that they needed themselves. So when we talk about why this is important, it is really about saying, look, we're sick of the breakups. We're sick of having to restart. We're sick of the pain that goes with short-term contracts. We're sick of getting some runs on the board that say this is a fantastic program. This is getting fantastic results. We're finally starting to see stalling in these horrific statistics that our families and communities have been dealing with for so many decades. And yet again, we haven't managed to move those structural barriers that stop us talking about pilots and move us into a framework where we're genuinely talking about ongoing support and dedicated models.
One of the things that, of course, you and the sector have been campaigning for was the establishment of a National Commissioner for First Nations Children and Young People.
Yes.
And now that that role has been established after years and years of activism, I wonder if you could share with us what your hope is now that you have been able to succeed in getting that position established and just acknowledging how much work of the sector went into having that happen.
Absolutely. Decades of calling for it. And again, our last conference, our 2025 SNAIP conference, the call was established now. And it happened. And it is one of the incredible strengths of being able to bring our sector's voice into forums like that. So, you know, when you have 2,000 people sitting in around a room, it not only brings to life the story of excellence and the gold standard that the Aboriginal community controls services offer in caring for children and families, it brings an incredible strength to that voice. So our last conference, which was only a couple of weeks ago, what the sector told us was legislate now and make sure that legislate is strong. And it asked the federal government to be bold and brave in that legislation. So in order for that commissioner to function, that's what we're all leaning in on. That's what the sector is asking for. Give us the commissioner that can do what she needs to do, give her the powers that she needs, and let's get some real, not only accountability into the legislation and policies that impact on our children, but also have the ability for our incredible, fearless commissioner to be able to work alongside governments to ensure those changes are happening and being implemented in the way that they were fashioned and designed. We're feeling we've got every fingers, all our toes crossed, and certainly we won't stop calling for it until it happens.
That was the CEO of SNAIP, Catherine Little, speaking about the importance of having community-based solutions that are backed by governments. That's the show for now. Join us again next time for more stories from across Indigenous Australia. Speaking Out is produced by Janaea Gibbs-Muir and Nadine Haynes. Our senior producer is Jay McAllister. And as always, you can find us on the ABC Listen app or on social media via ABC Indigenous, along with our titter show Away, hosted by the fabulous Rudy Bremer. I'm Larissa Berendt, and this is Speaking Out.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.